We're at the intersection of human dignity and LGBTQ plus equal rights and barriers to progress. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of researchers, they've examined how lawmakers, how policymakers, members of the media, and even some people within LGBTQ plus communities have used the concept of dignity to shame and weaken voices. How do you feel attitudes toward queer and trans communities have changed? Which debates are people still grappling with? Do you feel seen and heard? What is your story or message on how to break down stigma? It's 800-642-1234. The new book, it's called Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. And we have its co-authors. Stephen Engel is a politics professor at Bates College in Maine and an affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We also have Timothy Lyle, an assistant professor of English at Iona College in New York. Timothy, welcome to you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the word dignity. What does dignity mean to you? And Timothy, you go first.
That's a great question. You know, the book was sort of born from this idea that that dignity as a word to advocate for LGBTQ equality was having a moment. It's a major cornerstone for Supreme Court decisions involving LGBTQ rights. It's all over dialogue and pop culture. It finds its way into public health policy. And so, you know, we wanted to kind of probe this word a little bit. And we admit that while it's seemingly a simple question, actually, it does not have a simple answer. and ultimately, we look at how dignity has a kind of plasticity to it. And, you know, folks tend to think of it as this kind of fundamentally good thing. You know, who doesn't want to be recognized as having dignity or have that dignity affirmed by other people? But we wanted to remain open to flipping that question a little bit, kind of defamiliarizing that concept that's so commonplace, and ask more so how dignity has been used and how it's been used as an instrument of power across three major domains, public health and representation and law. And we ultimately argue that it becomes a tool for boundary making, a way to mark who has value and who doesn't in queer communities. What life paths are more valuable or count, who has access, who has safety. And so we're really trying to, you know, kind of open up the conversation a little bit and get us to move beyond this idea of dignity as just an unquestioned good.
Mm. Stephen, I'm kind of seeing this sliding scale in my head, you know, as we hear that dignity is having this moment. How do you interpret what this word means?
Yeah, so... As Timothy alluded, when we teach, we often tell our students that you must begin with a clear conception or a definition of your terms. And so we tried to start there, but what we found was that dignity doesn't have a stable meaning, right? It's deployed by different people to mean different things at different times. So the meaning is highly contextual. In my field of law and politics, we tend to think most often of dignity as a status, right? Something that we have or are recognized by others to have. And in this sense, we might think of having dignity is to have one's choices respected, right? But respect, we think, is a very slippery term. In some Supreme Court decisions, for example, that utilize the term dignity, the court has made clear that the Constitution requires that I respect your choice, even as I might disagree with it. The sort of canonical case in that regard is Lawrence versus Texas, which decriminalized consensual same-sex intimacy. But sometimes the court uses the exact same word, dignity, to mean something else entirely. And has been pointed out by a number of legal scholars, the marriage equality rulings is where the Supreme Court deploys dignity to mean respectability, or what we say is the idea that dignity is a status that you earn or are invested with by others for engaging in a behavior that other people consider worthy. So you're seen as, say, acting in a dignified way. Hmm. So here, dignity means a standard that one should live up to. But that seems to be the exact opposite of having one's choices respected, right? You're being, in the second sense, dignity is an external status that's granted to you rather than something that might be internal that allows you to make choices even if others disagree.
It reminds me, Stephen, about the school of thought, respectability politics, that says in order to be respectable, marginalized groups must, you know, ascribe to a certain standard set by the dominant group, and the dominant group being white people. So how do you connect the dots with dignity and respectability politics?
Well, I think dignity is in some sense a manifestation of that respectability, right? That the idea that to be dignified is to be least disruptive to the social norms. And as you've pointed out, social norms often claim to be universal, but actually center cisgender behavior, whiteness, heteronormative behavior. And so the most marginalized within our communities then get marked potentially as undignified.
Stephen Engel, professor of politics at Bates College. Timothy Lyle is here, assistant professor of English at Iona College, as we discuss their new book, Disrupting Dignity. With your thoughts, are you gay, lesbian, trans, a member of the LGBTQ plus community? Are you an ally? What are your thoughts on the issues with dignity and the term? 800-642-1234. Timothy, I want you to jump in here as to what you see in your research with this notion of respectability or being respectable.
Yeah, it's, you know, so my main area of study is literary and cultural studies. So I'm really interested in the cultural narratives that we tell, and particularly narratives that we tell about queer communities. And we're sort of in this moment of heightened visibility. You know, I'm thinking a lot about this, right? Pride, you know, you see, you know, every company is a rainbow somewhere, and you know, Netflix has a collection of Pride shows. You know, and it's, there's seemingly a lot to celebrate there, but I often sort of find that that visibility is of a certain kind. It comes at a certain cost. And so as I'm sort of looking at cultural representation and ideas of dignity, I'm looking to see what worldviews are promoted, what worldviews are naturalized or as normal, and how sameness, you know, kind of becomes the demands, and in that way, we're subject to a kind of disciplinary force rather than a kind of emancipating one. And so, you know, I'm really interested in thinking about how we can promote more inclusion, how we can make room for more bodies and more narratives, and, you know, how we can sort of continue to question whether or not visibility is always a good thing. And at the same time, recognize its value and thereby push for much better representation, much more equitable and inclusive representation. You know, we have to be nervous, you know, and cautious as we celebrate.
Yeah. And what you're mentioning there with Pride Month and the, you know, the marketing and the consumerism and the corporate overtures, corporate beliefs, you know, I wonder how you interpret that and how Pride Month has evolved since it was started in 1994, Timothy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm in New York City and I'm personally involved in the Reclaim Pride movement, which is all about sort of pushing back against that kind of rainbow capitalism, pushing back against the ways in which Pride has sort of been commodified and domesticated and you know, thought of as a parade rather than a march or a protest. And I think that we have to try to hold multiple truths at once, right? We need to be aware that you know, for someone young and in a rural part of the country, for example, it may be really valuable to see, you know, these rainbow logos kind of all over the place. But at the same time, we've got to recognize that some of these very corporations may actually be doing active harm to our communities through their employment policies, through their corporate dollars to certain politicians who are not voting to protect all the members of our communities. And so, you know, we're in a state of emergency, for example, in the experience of trans youth. And a lot of these companies that are putting up their, you know, sign of solidarity are at the same time investing in politicians that are actively trying to push legislation that's harmful. So it's really kind of a tricky line to walk, you know, to sort of celebrate the advancements that are undeniable, but at the same time, make sure that we know who's playing the music before we dance.
Yeah, look at all the layers. The book is called Disrupting Dignity. We have co-authors Timothy Lyle and Stephen Engel as they explain how to think differently about what constitutes LGBTQ plus progress. Are you a member of the community? Do you think that marriage equality was a big advancement? What are the milestones? What are the milestones and what is impaired progress? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're challenging assumptions about dignity here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're unpacking how different institutions within our society, touch points, have defined dignity and used it to reflect inclusivity. But the stigmatizing of the LGBTQ plus community persists. How does Hollywood portray LGBTQ plus characters? What plot lines, what shows demonstrate progress? What serves to perpetuate stereotypes? And then what federal or state legislation are you advocating for? What do you fear out of lawmakers? Join in 800-642-1234. We have the co-authors of Disrupting Dignity, Stephen Engel with us and Timothy Lyle. Stephen, I want to look at the early days of the AIDS crisis, and you examined how dignity operated. Can you draw some lines for us about public health and how what you've seen unfold in the COVID pandemic, what differences you might have noticed about today's public health politics surrounding LGBTQ plus communities compared to the early days of the AIDS crisis?
Yeah, so we began the book looking at a particular moment in the early days of the HIV/AIDS crisis in both New York City and San Francisco. And we looked at the public health awareness around the use and subsequent closure of bathhouses in both cities. And we found often that public health officials in both cities, while initially open to trying to find a way to regulate these really vital community spaces for our communities, ultimately issued what we call kind of an ultimatum, right? Be dignified or in fact die, right? The idea here is that, you know, if you don't behave in a particular way, that this public health crisis will worsen. And what we saw was, despite massive efforts within the community to work with public health officials, often leaders of these cities ultimately shamed gay men at a time when the public health crisis was making this community particularly vulnerable. And so when we think about public health policy in relationship to the current COVID crisis, I think one of the things we look for is how shame is used in that crisis to get people to behave in a particular way. And we want to be very careful about whether or not shame is what I would suggest to be an appropriate motivator for any action. And I think ultimately it is not.
It is not. You know, I'm wondering where you see the pushback on this when you're saying, hey, you must conform in a certain way. Is there any revolt there? Is there any resistance?
I think historically there has been, both within the HIV/AIDS crisis and certainly within the current crisis. But I think what we're trying to figure out is how dignity can be expansive and how dignity can be restrictive. And so one of the things that we're looking at is, if we carry the HIV/AIDS crisis forward in time, one of the case studies we look at in the book is the use of pre-exposure prophylactics, this idea of PrEP being used as a way to avoid transmission of the HIV/AIDS crisis. And even there, we find in some public health messaging that it is the respectable thing to do is to go on this medication. And that, in fact, some of the language used around untransmissibility is that if you maintain your health regimen and become untransmissible, that is a dignified position to be in, even when public health access or medication access is very regimented according to class status, according to racial status, because of the ways in which our health systems are structured. And so what we point out is that despite, even with this rhetoric, there are structural systems in place that make the acquiring of dignity very difficult for certain people.
Timothy, what do you see? What lessons do you can inform us today from the AIDS crisis?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, we began this book in that period because we were looking for a pivot, right? A moment where we really turned to dignity as a tool. And, you know, one of the things that we kind of argue is that while immediately people, marginalized communities, vulnerable communities might turn to a kind of respectability as an immediate sort of survival tactic in a vulnerable time, the problem, and Brittany Cooper argues this in her book, Eloquent Rage, in a different context, is that the problem survival strategy is when it becomes an ideology, and it becomes an ideology that then members, you know, of their own community sort of use to police each other. And so it kind of was a moment for us to say this vulnerable moment in time, some really important work happened. And through the politicization of a very confusing, very dangerous and very devastating virus, some of the work that the state had long wanted to accomplish before the AIDS crisis, you know, they were able to sort of accomplish through that virus and through the politicization of it. And I guess what's the most interesting for me, perhaps, is all of the supposedly undignified ways of being in the world, ways of thinking, ways of creating kinship, ways of spending time and space, decidedly queer of moving through the world. Those became diseased, those became denigrated. And for many, the context of danger and loss and grief, sort of, there's a kind of seductive and a manipulative quality to it that actually kind of forced some of those ways of being in the world to be left behind and lost, or at least, you know, really kind of covered up. So to your point about resistance earlier, we do see some folks in this, you know, early period pushing back against the politicization of the virus, saying, hey, we can both have these queer ways of being in the world and establish and maintain really sound public health policy. They don't have to be mutually exclusive, but they were battling a really tough force with the state and all the respectability politics that were being circulated in the community. But I also think that in the COVID era, we see a drastically different response, right? I mean, HIV was sort of happening to a disposable population, or so the Reagan administration believed. And we had years of inaction, years of red tape, years of lack of investment. But we also had a narrative of blame that went along with the virus. That I'm not sure, and a lack of compassion and a lack of legal protection. And I think that in the COVID era, we don't quite see that playing out the same way. We see a severe mobilization of resources. We see a worldwide reckoning with a similar experience. You know, during the AIDS crisis, it felt very much like you were in a war zone where the rest of the world was moving along unbothered and untouched. COVID seems like a very shared experience that is impacting everybody, and everybody's talking about it, and everybody's getting support. So, you know, it's a really, I think, while there's a lot of lessons to be learned, it's a very different
situation. Yeah. Let's bring in Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi.
Hi. Well, I will be buying the book. I'll start by saying thank you. And also, I'm very old, so I remember a time in life when my being gay was regarded as my being mentally diseased and a dangerous person to be around. A lot has happened over the 60 or more years that I've watched the evolution of gay dignity. And I'm thinking about a International Journal of Constitutional Law article titled There Is No Such Thing as a Right to Dignity, and also a book I read recently, Roy Grinker's Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. And to me, it seems as though, I hope the authors touched on this in the book, I think you must have. In many ways, even though within the law we are being granted supposedly equal rights, I think, in many sectors, we're still treated definitely as the other, the outsider, indeed the mentally ill person. This concept has been institutionalized within religious practice and elsewhere, and I'll stop there.
Well, Rich, we're going to get a response on the other side of this news as we examine the role of dignity, inequality for the LGBTQ plus community. We have co-authors Stephen Engel, politics professor at Bates College. Timothy Lyle teaches English at Iona College. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. Dignity has become a dominant lens through which LGBTQ plus rights have been viewed in our country. We're taking stock of the term across these pillars of our society on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The researchers, they studied whether dignity is too slippery of a term and whether it can be turned against the aspirations of the LGBTQ plus communities and their allies. What do you think? Is dignity having a moment? Can dignity provide a strong foundation for equal treatment? Does dignity mean respect for individual choices? Join in 800-642-1234. The book is called Disrupting Dignity, and co-authors Stephen Engel of Bates College and Timothy Lyle of Iona College. They stay with us for the hour. I want to go back to Rich in Rhinelander, who discussed equal rights in law doesn't mean that translates to areas like religion, to areas like healthcare, other institutions in society. And Rich also said that he's old enough to remember when being gay was considered having a mental illness. Stephen, you first.
Yeah. So Rich made a really interesting comment. They mentioned that dignity, or that they had read a book, that dignity is not a constitutional right. And I would argue that there's some validity to that idea. Dignity as a constitutional value is far more developed in international law and in the constitutional traditions from Europe and South Africa than in those of the United States. The U.S. Constitution does not contain an explicit dignity clause, where other national constitutions and international affirmations of human rights might, and even where dignity has some textual grounding in the U.S. Constitution, scholars and lawyers and judges do not agree on what the word means or what outcomes it guarantees. And I think speaking to the idea that dignity may mean different things across different domains or fields, I think one of the places where this bore itself out was in the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision from the Supreme Court in 2018. One side, the same-sex couple that sought goods and services from a bakery, said that the denial of those services was an affront to their dignity. And the baker claimed that being compelled to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding, that compulsion would be a denial of his dignity. And so ultimately, dignity as a legal standard, it doesn't offer a metric to decide competing rights claims. And so that's really a challenge that we investigate a lot in the book, right? How do you balance, if everybody has dignity, if dignity is this fundamental good, how do you balance whose dignity matters more without violating a principle of equality?
I just want to bring in the voice of that Colorado baker, Jack Phillips, who won a partial victory at the Supreme Court after refusing to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Here's Jack after that decision.
I was thrilled. The United States Supreme Court has decided that we can try and enter the wedding business again and realize that I serve everybody, and it's just that I don't create cakes for every occasion that people ask me to create.
Stephen, does the High Court have a definition of dignity?
Well, I think the High Court has a muddled definition of dignity, right? In some of these cases, dignity, as you suggested earlier, means respect for individual choice. In some of these cases, dignity means a status that is conferred by powerful others when you behave in a particular way that's valued. And those kinds of polar opposite definitions really make a challenge. But I want to chime in here. I think there's a lot of danger in how Jack Phillips just represented what the court did in his case, because I don't think that's what the court did. I was actually rereading the case yesterday. And in fact, Justice Kennedy, in writing for the majority, says repeatedly that we must affirm the dignity of gays and lesbians, that society has come to a place where we must affirm the dignity of the LGBTQ community. And in fact, when he looks at the balance of the issues, often the balance tips in favor of LGBTQ people having a right to access goods and services and public accommodations equally with all others. The case turned on a very narrow procedural claim that Jack Phillips' religious objection was not taken seriously enough by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And on that basis of a procedural error, he won the case. But it's very narrow. And what we see, in fact, is that a lot of these issues, like the Fulton decision versus the city of Philadelphia last week, these are very narrow decisions. And I'm worried that because, say, last week, Catholic Social Services officially won the decision unanimously, there's a tendency to think that these decisions mean much more than they may actually. And that there's an over emphasis on the victor's position, even when the court makes a very narrow decision.
Yeah. You mentioned former Justice Anthony Kennedy, and, you know, in that decision about marriage equality being the law of the land, and he wrote that laws excluding same-sex couples from the marriage right impose stigma and injury of the kind prohibited, end quote. You know, as you look at these decisions, Timothy Lyle, what do you make of them and as how the high court navigates the issue of dignity?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think that Kennedy has sort of created his own dignity, you know, rhetoric. You know, it's kind of his own doctrine that he's been spinning in these cases. But I also just think that we need to be really mindful of all of the language that's being used. You know, I come at this from a linguistic perspective and thinking about how we do things with words. And so I, you know, want us to be really cautious about the particular routes that we're taking and really careful in thinking about what we're actually accomplishing, how protected we actually are. You know, if every person in our community is actually being protected in the way that we perhaps think they are when we're celebrating these decisions. And I think reading the fine print of some of them, you know, is really, really helpful. You know, I think to the Bostock decision last year, which, you know, was a seemingly a cause for great celebration. But at the same time, there was a clear indication from the conservative part of the court that, you know, bring this case to us from a freedom of religion and expression, and, you know, we'll perhaps solve this very differently. You know, I think that we just really need to be mindful of the strategies that we're using and what we're actually accomplishing and where they might be used to support conservative ends, actually, that would make us really uncomfortable.
Timothy Lyle there. We also have Stephen Engel, co-authors of Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. You can join in. How do you feel attitudes toward queer and trans communities have changed? Which debates, what language is out there that you are grappling with? And what does it indicate? Where do you see shame? Where do you see people raising you up, hearing your voice? 800-642-1234. Bill is joining us in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that I was listening to the program, and they're talking quite a bit about shame associated with the gay community and so forth. And I wanted to mention the work, thinking of a literary critic at the University of Texas in Dallas, Frederick Turner, who has proposed what I call, he doesn't, but I call it a theory of values, in which he suggests that the experience of values such as beauty, meaning, and community begin with the experience of otherness, which he sees as fundamentally troubling to the self-conscious self. That it actually bringing about a feeling of shame because the other has qualities that you lack. And shame is defined, actually, in the dictionary as the response to one's limitations. And he proposes, drawing on the work of his parents, Victor and Edith Turner, that the function of ritual and the arts, the what I call the technologies of the imagination, is to transmute, or as he says, to provide the tools humans need to pass through shame to beauty, meaning, and community.
Timothy, could you parse those words?
I was sort of just interested in hearing him talk. I think this question of making meaning relationally, is really important, and how we sort of constitute meaning in the world relationally. But also, there is in relationality this sense of power, right, that we have to contend with, especially when we're thinking about, majority cultures, kind of versus minority cultures. And I do think that it's sort of important for us to look at how we make meaning by demanding sameness versus making meaning by embracing difference. And I think that a lot of sort of normative thrusts, and normative demands come from a fear of difference, and come from a fear of not being able to make meaning in the world in a clear and stable and neatly classified way. And I find that a lot of queer people disrupt all of those impulses to categorize and to make meaning relationally in a neat, tight way. And so that's why I think that paying attention to words like dignity are so crucial, because they're so seductive. They're tied to really powerful social rewards and social punishments for folks who are either, approximating those values or not. And so it's really seductive, and a lot of, I think, other ways of being in the world get rendered illegitimate and dangerous and irresponsible and unproductive. And that can really impact the way that people see themselves and the way they see their collectives.
Yeah. Stephen, what is coming up for you?
Yeah, I think one of the things the caller mentioned that I found really interesting was the using of the arts to challenge our conceptions of self. And I think in our book, we explore pop culture and look at television shows and films that take on LGBTQ themes and characters. And when do those shows or films, when do they reinforce a kind of sense of dignity that is disciplining? And when do they offer a new or more expansive and inclusive concept of dignity? So, for example, we look at the 2018 film Love, Simon, mm-hmm. and we explore how the character and the narrative of the film really actually center not the cisgender white gay male high school senior, but actually the straight family, the straight friends, the straight gaze, right? The straight view of that character. And we contrast this with another series that also premiered the same year in 2018, FX's series Pose. And we look at how Pose offers a very different way that we can conceptualize dignity through its focus on transgender women of color, how dignity is not necessarily individualized, but realized in community with others. And so throughout the book, we're constantly looking at sort of how what dignity means in terms of how it might be overly narrow, and also ways in which the communities challenge that definition and offer up some possibilities that we want to explore and celebrate. And we're sort of interested in that dialogue between the two.
Stephen Engel and Timothy Lyle, they are studying dignity's many meanings, how the term holds back the LGBTQ plus community. Did you see Love, Simon? How did it make you feel? Could you relate to the main character? Are you a fan of FX's drama Pose? What do you like most about the show? How do you think? How do you think the show portrays LGBTQ plus characters differently? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. All this hour, we've been taking this long look at dignity and whether it's been a tool for promoting hurtful stigmas and stereotypes, or is it doing the opposite in the pursuit of creating a more inclusive America, more inclusive Wisconsin? The book is called Disrupting Dignity, and co-authors Timothy Lyle and Stephen Engel, they stay with us for about 10 more minutes. I want to continue that thread we were on there about pop culture. And in FX's drama Pose, the characters, you know, pray tell, they visit Heart Island. And co-creator and producer Steve Canals, he talked about the island when discussing the scene.
The fear was that if these bodies were buried near residential communities, then maybe HIV was going to seep into the, you know, soil, and it would get into the, you know, water. And so they just wanted the bodies to be away.
Each one of these heart-shaped rocks represents someone buried here, left by someone left behind.
Timothy, can you explain Heart Island and what is going on in that scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's another great example. I think this was the season two lead episode premiere. That's the word I was looking for, of season two. And it really kind of continues the work of Pose in kind of serving as a historical primer for queer audiences and for other audiences who may be interested in queer history. And they took on, you know, the specific narrative of Heart Island to kind of excavate that history and to kind of humanize the folks that were dehumanized and dumped in unmarked graves and pine boxes on Heart Island. And they really tried to restore, you know, kind of what was lost and what was taken. And, you know, we see the show continuing to point to the value of queer history, continuing to point to the need to dig up some of those histories and or to even retell in more inclusive ways some of the queer histories that do already circulate, particularly around Black and brown, trans and queer communities. And so we really do see, I think, a strong focus on community, a strong focus on reckoning with loss and trying to heal and to repair, you know, some of the stuff that has been fractured and broken.
And Stephen, you looked at recent legislation over Heart Island, which functions as a public cemetery for unclaimed people in New York City. A tenth of the people who died from COVID were buried on Heart Island. Also, bodies of many who died from the AIDS crisis are buried there. What have you found in terms of legislation and what is happening?
Yeah, I think a couple years ago, the New York City Council passed legislation to make Heart Island far more accessible. They transferred jurisdiction, I think, to the Parks Department. And Speaker Cory Johnson at that time tweeted out that doing so was one step in giving people who are buried at Heart Island a more dignified passing than might have been available to them at the time of their actual death. And I think that also inspired, well, what does that mean, right? And what does it mean to do that dignity, to do what the city council did? And I think that led us, in our book, you know, we've talked a lot about our criticisms of dignity, But we don't just want to tear down. We wanted to figure out how to build up some alternatives. And as we said at the top of the show, how to do dignity a little bit differently. And I think one of the things we're looking at are some options across these three domains of public health, pop culture, and constitutional decision making about how dignity can be done differently if it embraces this idea of being a guard against stigma. Right? That if we can guard against, or it can be an anti-stigma principle, what might that anti-stigma principle lead us to do? What kinds of actions might it make us take? And in my area of constitutional law, an anti-stigma principle may actually help us think through the parts of the Constitution that might be better than the Equal Treatment Clause to actually get some equal treatment. And in particular, we look at the 13th Amendment, the ban on slavery, as really a ban on what the Supreme Court has long called badges of inferiority. And so is there some repository of dignity that we can reclaim if we take the 13th Amendment more seriously as a constitutional principle that we can act upon?
I was just going to jump in here and ask Timothy, too, when you think of where language is headed, where the next big advancement toward equality is headed, what do you see?
You know, I think a continuous expansion of language. You know, one of the things that queer people have always done is pointed to how language fails us. And sort of pushing for new vocabulary, pushing for more inclusive vocabulary. So, you know, I see the conversations around pronouns as being really hopeful, you know, recognition of even more gender identities other than just, you know, cisgender and trans. I think that we are looking for ways to capture as many different experiences and to fully celebrate difference. And, you know, and I think that speaking of pose, you know, inviting some of the most vulnerable of our community to the writing room to shape content, right? Trans women of color, brown and black queer folk, you know, being in the writing room, shaping the content, not just being referenced by, you know, a straight actor or being written about by non-queer people in writing rooms.
What other way could you find? Yeah, I mean, what other way could you find authenticity if not that?
Yeah, exactly. And I also think, you know, to our arguments about dignity, we find that the folks who have been the most barred from ideas of dignity and respectability, right? Folks that are so abjected, you know, for their radical difference, that those are the folks that are actually least seduced sometimes by the pangs of dignity and provide us with our most promising alternatives.
Well, thank you both for joining us for this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Engel, politics professor at Bates College, and Timothy Lyle, an assistant professor of English at Iona College. Their book is called Disrupting Dignity, Rethinking Power and Progress in LGBTQ Lives. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.